I'm Lynn Waters, and welcome to Dialogue, a time in which we address the problems and concerns that touch all of our lives, and also a chance that we give you to participate by calling us with your questions and comments. Tonight, we're going to look at shopping in the legal market. How do you decide if you need a lawyer? Where do you go to look for one? And what can you expect when you do find one? We have a panel of experts in the studio tonight waiting to answer your questions. They're all laughing, but they really are. And react to your comments. We'd like to introduce you to them. Aline Richardson is Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Hawaii, which provides free legal services to eligible low-income individuals and families. And Eric Moon, Chief Deputy with the Public Defender's Office, which provides legal services involving criminal matters to those individuals who also meet the income limits. Across the table, Richard Kawana, Chief Disciplinary Counsel with the Supreme Court of Hawaii's Disciplinary Board, which addresses complaints involving possible unethical conduct by an attorney. And Peter Adler, Executive Director of the Neighborhood Justice Center, which offers mediation and other assistance to try to solve problems without taking them to court. Thank you all for coming out to be with us this evening. We'll return in a moment, but first we want to remind you that Dialogue is live and it's your show, so we want you to call us. The number is 955-7878. If you have any questions about legal advice or comments about anything that comes up in the discussion tonight, if you're watching from a neighbor island, please call us collect, 955-7878. Our telephone operators are waiting for your call. Why don't we start out by talking about how you decide you need an attorney? A lot of us get in difficult situations, but we don't really know if we should seek professional advice. Eric, how do you make a decision like that?
I think it would probably be apparent to the person as to whether or not he feels he needs an attorney. In what we deal with, I think we deal principally with persons who have been charged with some criminal act. And I think in any case, the person should seek the advice of an attorney as to how he goes about finding an attorney. I suppose it depends. If he doesn't have any funds to hire an attorney, then it's easy. He'll either come to us or see the Legal Aid Society. But if he has some money, then it becomes a little bit more of a problem, because then he wants the best that he can afford.
And the Public Defender's Office, as we said before, deals primarily with criminal matters, right?
Right. With any person whose liberty may be threatened. In other words, any person who may be locked up, which includes mental commitment cases.
And Aline, legal aid deals with civil matters mainly?
Correct. We're basically Eric's counterpart. And for anything that's not criminal or not dealing with mental commitment, legal aid will do. In other words, we do complex divorce situations, public entitlement, landlord, tenant, consumer, education, health, social security, unemployment. And any of the myriad civil issues that are apparent in any of our society, we will deal with them if they are income eligible.
Do you find that the people that come into legal aid, they do the most majority of them really need an attorney?
Most of them need an attorney, and they have, usually when they walk in, they have more than one legal problem. They come in for one legal problem, and we will go over there just their facts and their lives, and we'll find out that they've got a whole bunch of other kind of problems that they need to have solved just because they have living situations that are very difficult. There are certain cases where I would encourage people to not seek out legal assistance, and that would be in family situations involving such things as visitation or custody. And that would be, I would refer these people to groups like Peter's, where they are fighting over your basic nitty-gritty, what time you're going to pick up your kids, when you're going to drop them off, where you're going to pick them up, where you're going to drop them off, and how long you're going to have those kids. And those kind of things, people tend to come in and ask for a lawyer immediately. And they don't need to see a lawyer. What they need to do is see somebody who can objectively handle their problems without running up all these incredible legal fees or taking up a lot of our services time, which, you know, our attorneys are free. But they need somebody who could just objectively handle domestic problems like that.
Peter, are those the kind of cases that the Neighborhood Justice Center deals with?
I think so, among others. Our basic proposition is to try and settle cases out of court. And I guess my own bias is that when people find themselves in a conflict or a dispute, that the first inclination be really to try and work it out with the person they're having the dispute with. And if they can't, then mediation is one option, as is legal recourse is another option. We do deal with a lot of family matters, visitation, custody, division of some household and personal properties, those kinds of things. And a lot of other situations where the relationships are ongoing, where beyond the conflict, people will still have to deal with each other.
Would you encourage people to contact the Neighborhood Justice Center before they seek legal advice?
I think so. I would, yeah. I think we come from a philosophy that people really can solve many of their own problems, and with a little bit of assistance, with a little bit of third-party assistance, they really can avoid a lot of litigation. And we're not necessarily against litigation, because we think, I mean, it serves its purpose and it's needed, but not for everything. We've got kind of a knee-jerk reaction in our society to hire an attorney at the drop of a hat. I think mediation is a response to kind of a big problem of over-litigation.
Richard, you deal with ethics.
Right.
What if somebody does get an attorney and is not happy with the situation or maybe thinks there's some problem there?
Well, first of all, I guess to add on to what has been said before, I've found that most of the complaints, it seems like we get several of them every day, deal with divorces. And basically, I think it's that type of situation where people are so emotional that they can't get together and they can't decide on how to deal with this most important event in their lives, how to break off, you know, amicably. And so they go to a lawyer, one on each side, and they get the third person in, which is the judge. And the judge is, you know, not involved. He's supposed to be a disinterested third party, and he has to make an arbitrary decision. Well, not arbitrary, but certainly he has to make a decision that is not going to be agreeable to both sides. And as a result, both sides think that the lawyer hasn't done what the lawyer has been paid to do, that is, work a miracle, I guess. Mm-hmm. And really, I think that reinforces what the others have said, that for something like this, perhaps the best thing to do, especially in a family situation, is to see if you can work it out together. That way you have some input in the final result, rather than leaving it to a judge. Although they try their best, certainly. In terms of what we do as far as complaints are concerned, when we get complaints, we ask that the people who want to complain put their complaints in writing, because as Aline mentioned, one of the problems is that people have this mass, amorphous mass of problems that they feel that something should be done about, but they haven't really sat down and thought, try to think it through. So what we do is we ask people to put their complaints in writing, and that helps to focus upon the specific issues that they want to raise. Once we get it, we send it over to the lawyer and ask the lawyer to respond also in writing, and then we get back with the person to file the complaint and see whether we have anything there. So I guess it's a process involving communication.
What can you expect when you do decide to get a lawyer and you go for a first visit, a preliminary consultation? What can you expect from there on out? Like, how much does it cost? And
you should expect to be able to, in about an hour and a half, if not less, be able to articulate your problem and ask him how much he will charge for the fees. And he should be able to give you a certain ballpark figure, and he should say that if it gets any more complex, he will charge you so much more money for it. But you should have an idea of what the problem is, what he'll do for it, and how much he'll charge for it, if you're going to a person you're paying money to. And there are times that he will not tell you. Well, he may. I take that back. He may. He may tell you that you don't need an attorney, and that probably you can solve the problem on your own. I don't know, because when I was doing domestic work, you'd be surprised how many people fight over the newly purchased refrigerator. And, you know, basically all number of lawyer hours that went on for the other private attorney on the other side who was fighting for it, they could have bought a new one. You know, but they basically should have found a mediator for something like that.
What are we talking about in the way of fees? What is the fee for an attorney?
Depends on what kind of action, really.
But almost always it's based on the hour, an hourly rate, right?
Right.
Right. Contingent fees are also a fee where the attorney gets a percentage of the final recovery. But primarily, I think most people do it on an hourly rate, except for an uncontested divorce or something of that nature, where the you know, it's pretty clear what the output of time will be. And in which case, I think most people have seen ads in the paper, for example, where attorneys will say that they'll charge, you know, $90 or $100 for an uncontested divorce, something of that nature. And the fact that lawyers are advertising, I think, is a reflection that the Supreme Court of the United States, as well as our disciplinary board, is interested in allowing lawyers to publish this type of information so that more people can be aware of, you know, what lawyers are charging. But basically, I think that it's something that has to be decided by the lawyer and the client. I mean, there has to be a clear understanding. I think that's another problem that we often get questions about fee disputes. Now, our office doesn't deal with fee disputes, and as a matter of fact, we refer them to the Hawaii State Bar Association, which has an attorney-client coordination committee, which mediates and with the consent of the parties involved, arbitrates fee disputes. And once again, it's a type of situation that probably can be avoided if, when a potential client goes in to talk to a lawyer, they discuss what the fees are going to be, what the lawyer expects to be charging them, and best of all, get it in writing, get a retainer agreement in writing so that later on, there won't be a misunderstanding on either side about what was being charged for. I found that that seems to be a lawyer can have a legitimate and reasonable expectation of what he's going to charge the client, and the client can have a legitimate and reasonable expectation about what the lawyer said that he was going to be charged, and yet they're far apart. Sometimes, if you get it in writing, it helps to make sure that both of you are on the right track.
If you have retained an attorney, you should at least ask him to bill you every month. I have found that there are some clients who don't get their billing every month, they get it every quarter, or whenever there's a service rendered, and sometimes because of the nature of the case, it goes once every 6 months, but then they don't know. And the fact that they don't know causes them to have problems, and I think they should just ask to be billed every month, every 30 days, and whether it's zero or $1,000, they should be billed.
What, Peter, do you have a lot of experience with people that maybe are over the income limit to have legal aid or public defender services, but really don't have the money to hire an attorney?
Well, yeah, I think most of the people who are using mediation over the last couple years, or maybe I should say in the first few years of the Neighborhood Justice Center's existence, were probably low and moderate income families. We're finding a gradual rise in that because I think the mediation is being more and more accepted as a viable alternative or as an initial alternative to be explored. So I think we're seeing more and more people with slightly higher incomes coming in and seeking out mediation as an alternative.
I want to take this a moment to remind our viewers that we are live right now. So if you have a question about legal advice or a comment, please call us. The number is 955-7878. To anyone on the panel, how does one select a lawyer to draft a will, and how much would an attorney charge for such a service?
It really depends on how complex the will is and how much property the person owns. You'd really have to ask the client. It's such a broad question. I would say call the Bar Associates Lawyer Referral Service, and if you've got anything over $40,000 in assets, and anybody who owns property or an apartment has got more than $40,000 in equity, should call Lawyer Referral Service. They have a panel who will be able to do draft a will or do something further. You may not need a will. You may need estate planning. You may get everything. You may divest yourself of all the property beforehand as a as a result of estate planning and need no will. But it really depends on the size of the estate.
We're going to mention also the bar referral service is a good way to find a lawyer,
yeah,
if people don't have it. That is one of the ways, clearinghouses that provide you names and so on.
So you could call them and tell them what you're looking for, what kind of service you need, and they would be able to put you in touch with somebody.
The more complex your estate, the more expensive it's going to be. Just to get away, around to deal with estate taxes.
I might also point out that the referral service, I think, gives three names in a particular area. And many of them will have an initial consultation without charge. And I'd like to suggest that if people can do it, talk to all three of them.
Shop around, really.
I think, once again, going back to legal fees, rates differ. Some people charge more than others. Some people get along with you better than others. It's a combination of price as well as how well you can get along with a lawyer. An attorney-client relationship is, it's something that that has to be developed, and obviously you can work with some lawyers better than others.
Mm-hmm. Aline, legal aid is available for low-income families. What is considered low-income for eligibility?
Well, basically, it depends on the size of the family. And you should call in to find out what it is, because I could go down a family of one per month, two, three, four, five, six. And basically, it's the poverty level set by the Housing and Urban Development in Washington, D.C., and we're published in the Federal Register. I think, Eric, you and I have the same regulations, I think.
We're not involved with the federal government, so we have our, we have to qualify our potential clients on an economic basis. What we do is we decide whether or not a person qualifies on a case-by-case basis, depending on what the man is charged with, or woman. If he's charged with a felony, it's easier for that person to qualify, because if he were to go out on a and find an attorney when he's charged with a felony, depending on what class it is, it's going to run in the thousands. And criminal attorneys, they want to collect as much of the fee as they can up front. And not too many people can raise $10,000, that soon. So it depends on what he's charged with and his, we take into consideration his income and his expenses and his assets. And we decide on a case-by-case basis.
This is an easy one. How many of the panelists have passed the bar exam in the state of Hawaii?
Oh,
yeah.
I did.
I'm not an attorney, so I didn't have to
take it. You're at the Justice Center, so you didn't have to take it. Okay. Who pays for the free services provided by Legal Aid and the public defenders?
Legal Aid is a nonprofit corporation, and we're 30 years old. We're supported 50% by the state of Hawaii. Approximately 38% by the federal government through the Legal Services Corporation in Washington, D.C., and through various grants from the counties and Aloha United Way and the Hawaii Island United Way.
We're a statewide office, and we get paid by the state.
All righty. What legal recourse do citizens have if they have a contract, i.e. tenant, with someone who becomes a prisoner within the Hawaii penal system? Eric?
That's a question for legal aid to decide.
Wait, could you read that again?
What legal recourse does a citizen have if they have a contract, such as a tenant contract, with someone who becomes a prisoner within the Hawaii penal system?
Landlord asking.
Oh, a landlord asking against a prisoner who just was a tenant and now a prisoner. Basically, he has, I hate to tell the landlord, but he's got an action for damages against the tenant, and he can sue the inmate, wherever the inmate is located. Whether he will collect is an entirely different thing. But he has recourse in the court. It's very easy, because they bring the prisoner out of the correctional facility and bring him into court. But the problem is basically recovering on the judgment.
And the prisoner then can in turn sue the state for putting him there in the first place.
I suppose, but I'm not
Sounds confusing. Okay, let's see. Call from Kaimu Key. This person respects lawyers and their representation, but is irked when they must represent and defend clients who are obviously guilty. He believes they really lose their credibility when they do this. They must see both sides. And I can't read the rest of it, but somebody would like to comment on that?
You know, that's a lot of people just do not understand what a lawyer's obligation is, especially in a criminal case where they always ask, if the person is guilty, how can you defend them? Well, in a criminal justice system, the Constitution provides that every person who's charged with a crime has a right to effective legal representation. And it, as a defense attorney, it's not my responsibility to determine whether the guy's guilty or not. My responsibility would be to make sure that all of his constitutional rights are protected throughout the system. In other words, to assure that he gets a fair trial. The main purpose, of course, is to see that if he does get convicted, the government did so in accordance with his rights. And so we, defense attorneys in criminal cases, generally, I don't think they have any hesitation in representing a person, even if it looks as though he's obviously guilty.
I know you've probably had this question asked to you many times, but there are people that would want to know, how can you, say if you have a client that you know is guilty, how can you reconcile your personal ethics with trying to get this guy off?
Okay, as far as ethically, as long as we do our job and remain within our ethical bounds, and if we are successful and the person is found not guilty, I don't feel anything. I feel that if I did my job and if the prosecution didn't do theirs, well, that's not my fault. If they dropped the ball, that's their problem.
I might point out, Lynn, that the Code of Professional Responsibility states in Canon 7 that the lawyer has an ethical obligation to represent his client zealously within the bounds of the law. So what defense attorneys are doing is simply that, representing their clients within the bounds of the law to give them the opportunity to call upon all of the rights that any citizen has.
Okay, question for Peter. How does dispute mediation save the city money rather than going through litigation?
I'm not sure it saves the city directly. I think it saves taxpayers in general a fair amount of money because in a sense it's preventing litigation, it's preventive litigation. And getting people to solve their own problems on their own, in essence, stops the case from escalating. We did a bit of an analysis after the first 2 years, and we were trying to compare costs of mediation, how much we'd actually spent in resolving a certain number of cases, versus how much those cases would have cost through the prosecutor or through the family court. It was very hard to get those figures, too, I might say, from both the prosecutor and the family court, but we figured out several $100,000 just in the first couple of years. So in essence, it's a preventive process. It's a first step that people can settle it. They've kept it out of the system.
You see, you save the court time.
Can I ask a question? Do you get any referrals from the prosecutor's office? Because I know that the prosecutor's office, cases are initiated not only by police arrests, but also by private citizen complaints made through the prosecutor's office. And I have found that we have oftentimes clients that are involved in neighbor disputes, too much noise or things like that. And the prosecutors, believe it or not, they file a complaint and they bring this person to criminal court. And I was just wondering if you get any referrals from the prosecutor's office trying to settle these problems where it's clear that it's resulting from actually a neighbor dispute.
We've gotten quite a few referrals from the prosecutor's office, and I think there are two kinds. One is cases where the prosecutor clearly is not going to take any action. There's no evidence. There's no place where they think the case is going to go. So they will suggest, one, if you try mediation as an alternative. The second kind of case is some prosecutors that are sensitive to the mediation process, I think where there are two parties in an ongoing relationship, such as family, such as neighbors, have recognized that if they can settle it on their own through mediation, it's going to probably be a better solution. And so they have referred some cases, but it's been very uneven, I might say. It really depends on the particular prosecutor, the particular deputy.
Yeah.
Next question. Why does the Legal Aid Society put its efforts on left-wing causes when it's subsidized by the community?
Why is that?
This is from Molokai.
What can I say? I'm not quite sure what a left-wing cause is. We have represented certain issues which are very controversial, and I'm not sure whether saying that because it's controversial is left-wing. I'm not sure. Basically, the way the program has run in the past is that poor people, and these are basically poverty-level people, have just as much to an attorney, right to an attorney, as anyone else, and some of their interests are those interests which are contrary to, shall we say, the mainstream society. Some of them are to perpetuate certain type of lifestyle, or are against certain types of projects, which other people may not necessarily agree, but they feel it affects their lives and the way they live, and as a result, because they are poor people and they have come in with a problem, we do represent them. Basically, for clarification to the audience, the board of directors every 2 years goes through a priority process of the type of cases that will be taken by legal aid. There are approximately 188,000 poor people in the state of Hawaii, and we cannot possibly take on all the kind of legal issues that are presented by this population. And the only way to do it is to prioritize. The only way to prioritize is to get a feedback from the community. Every 2 years we do the survey, and we have public hearings, and we have meetings where people come out and tell us what they think we should do. And what's ended up happening is that we've got 10 priorities, and some of them are community education, public entitlements, which includes welfare and food stamps, unemployment, landlord-tenant, including public housing, land, water, and Native Hawaiian issues. That might be one of the things that they're looking at, but it's a priority that has been regarded by the community in their input to us as a high priority, and so therefore we do service for those kind of issues.
You know, Lynn, I think that illustrates the point that was raised previously about what defense attorneys are doing, because under the Code of Professional Responsibility, again, lawyers are encouraged to provide legal representation to even those involved in controversial or unpopular causes. I mean, it's an obligation of the profession to make sure that people who would otherwise not be represented have legal counsel. And so I think by the very nature of that obligation, sometimes there are controversial issues or unpopular causes that lawyers who feel that obligation step forward and try to fulfill it. And I think that, for example, the Public Defender's Office is sort of a structurally created, a reflection of that obligation.
This is a less controversial question. Are holographic wills legal in Hawaii?
I don't think they are.
I don't think they are either.
Okay. This caller has had this caller has had a bad experience with prepaid legal plans. The person avoids actually providing service. What is your opinion, experience with such plans? How can an unhappy subscriber get help?
Well, if you have, whether a lawyer is with the public defender or the legal aid society or with the prosecutor's office or with the government or with a prepaid legal plan, he has individual ethical, and I'm not saying that they're all alike, he has individual ethical responsibilities to fulfill. And certainly if the caller believes that the lawyer is acting unprofessionally, then our office would certainly be willing to entertain her complaint or his complaint and see whether or not we have jurisdiction in the matter.
So, except for our government agencies like Legal Aid and the Public Defender's Office, I think the saying that you get what you pay for is pretty much it applies to attorneys as well. Except for the government agencies.
Do you want to elaborate on that?
Well, if an attorney has only so much time in a day to do his work, and if he's going to advertise or get involved with I don't really know that much about a prepaid legal service plan, but you want to get a whole bunch load of clients at one time, and he's charging, you know, under the going rate, then, you know, how good a job or how much time can he spend on each individual case? Not much. So that's why I say you get what
so,
you pay for.
So the client should take that into consideration when...
I think so. I mean, it's not true in every case, but I think sometimes an attorney gets pressed for time, you know, and he's gotta get the paperwork out, and he'll do it to meet his deadline. But you gotta remember that if there's another case which he's involved in, which is bringing him much more income, you know, his priority is there, where the money is.
Well, I might also put a slightly different twist on that. One of the cases that we had involved an attorney who couldn't say no. In other words, people would come in and, you know, have a story of, you know, some type of hard luck story, or I need legal assistance and I can't pay for it, can you take my case? Well, what happened was he took so many cases that he couldn't do